This is Winging It Podcast, the podcast for people who don't have their shit together.
I'm a classic man. You can be mean when you look this clean. I'm a classic man. Calling on me like a young OG. I'm a classic man. Your knees get met by the street.
We're back with the Winging It Podcast. My name is Rashad Howard, and I have a very, very special guest today. This gentleman has an amazing story that has been something that's truly inspiring to me, not just from, and see, we're doing it from his actual store, so we're going to get all the store noise, which is a beautiful thing, but it's not just inspiring in the typical sense where you hear someone who's gone through tremendous business issues and overcome them, but this man literally shouldn't even be here today, but he's taken every aspect of his life and he's given it away to figure out how to inspire others, not just through the clothing and through the aesthetics and through the fashion, through the motivational speaking, through all the different events he puts together, but also through actually changing history in the course of human history for young black boys in this country. Today we have none other than the venerable, the amazing Miguel Wilson.
How do I respond to that? Thank you. You're much too kind, my brother.
not even. So we're here at Miguel Wilson, Washington, D.C., and I can't wait to get in to talk a little bit more about, like, how we even came back home for you.
Right.
I ran into you in Atlanta, and, you know, you don't know this, but I was working on, like, personal branding and kind of trying to change my whole, you know, look and feel and get my own confidence back in many ways as a business owner. And if not for being able to stop into Miguel Wilson and, you know, rent some tuxes for the videos, rent some good looks for the videos, I mean, I don't know, like, how that would have worked out. I had a whole wardrobe change on day one. It was dope, man. That's all because of you.
It's surprising to hear you say, get your confidence back. I mean, you're such a successful business person, and success generally leads to a great deal of confidence. In some cases, even, you know, extreme confidence.
True.
So it's surprising to hear you talk about, you know, getting your confidence back.
We're all on a
journey.
That
level of success.
We're all on a journey, man.
Right.
We're all on a journey. So in front of you, you got an ego coin, right? And the concept here is that, you know, there's two sides to the coin. There's the ego, the piece of it, that overconfidence that you talked about a second ago. That's the ego that we all know. And the thing that drives us sometimes, but also drives people away. The other side of the ego coin is the part that convinces us to play small. The piece, the little voice inside of our heads that tell us we don't deserve something. We shouldn't be here. Who am I to think that I could? And it's the bad memory that goes back in time and only remembers our failures and replays those in front of us at all times.
Right.
And so in order to have our conversation, we check both so that we can just get to the heart of the matter. So I'll start it off and then it's on you. All right. So my name is Rashad Howard. I'm deeply excited to be here. Today I check any feelings of inadequacy, and I check any need to try to perform, and I check all of my knowledge of your story to try to drive you to say something that I want you to say. I just want you to share whatever works with you.
Right.
And so with that, my ego is checked.
All right.
Your turn, sir.
To check.
Check your ego.
Okay. So I check anything other than authenticity. I check anything that will prevent me from speaking my truth.
That's
no
right.
Matter how embarrassing it may seem, or how less than perception it may be, I check.
My man. Okay.
All right.
And so now that we've got the egos checked, with that, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll get into the day of great despair, and then we'll get into your story.
Okay, great. Thanks. Right.
Take a few minutes to mellow out. Big Daddy Kane is on the mic, and I'ma tell about a minimum length of rhymes with strength and power. So listen to the man of the hour. Flow and go to a slow tempo, and you know, sing ho, swing low, then yo, the show will go on as I perform, transforming on stage. I got the soul
And we're back again. So one other thing that we always talk about is kind of what I was explaining a minute ago, is that we want to talk about all the things in your story, but we also want to hear about what we call the day of great despair. And that's a day or a period in life when it was bad.
Oh, yeah.
And you had to recover.
Yeah.
And so, or you're still recovering, whatever it is. Oh. And so we get into that. So with that, man, we're just going to kind of jump into it. So who is Miguel Wilson, man? Where are you from? How'd you get started? Who are
man, you?
You
know what? I'm a native Washingtonian.
Yes, sir.
I wear that on my sleeve everywhere I go.
You actually wear it on your sleeve. That's the thing.
Man, that's my, you know what I'm saying? I'm a D.C. guy through and through to the heart. Redskins, you know, the Bullets.
Uh-huh. I ain't never. Half smokes.
That too. Yeah, all that crabs. You know. So, I grew up in Washington. I think that, you know, I really attribute, you know, my upbringing here to, you know, being the type of person I am and so forth. The good and the bad, okay? Because, you know, it's you got to sometimes realize, you know, where you're from and your upbringing can also instill in you some negative things that you have to overcome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, you grew up, I think you told me it was Northeast primarily.
Northwest. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not going to kill you for that. But
that's all good, man. My bad. I forgot. But you had said something about something. You grew up in maybe not the greatest of neighborhoods.
Correct.
But there was something that always kept you out of the kinds of trouble you could have gotten into. You talk about
that. You know, I went to a camp as a kid, and at this camp, I got exposed to horses.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately fell in love with horses. It was spontaneous. It was that moment that literally changed my life, because even when I left camp and went back home, I had that desire, that itch, that passion to be around horses, and that led to me going to the library, getting books about horses. You know, I wanted to be in that environment, and I was fortunate enough that my great-grandmother, on her limited income, provided for me the opportunity to take riding lessons.
Really?
Yeah, and so I went and took riding lessons in Upper Marlboro. You know, a significant thing happened to me that may not happen to a lot of kids during that time, and that was the ride out to the barn.
Right.
Well, seeing the, you know, I inner city kids live in an environment of a lot of stress.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And in that stressful environment, you just don't realize you're stressed.
That's true.
You just experience things, you know. So riding out there, I felt the stress leave my body as I got further out, and I saw trees and I saw houses and I saw green grass and I saw animals, and it was like just a shoulders dropped a little.
Yeah.
You know, relaxed in my neck a little more. I got excited. The further I got away from the city, the closer I got to the barn. And just, you know, that first pulling up in that barn and seeing the horses just was life-changing for me. It was a moment that I was able to escape the jungle and be in an environment of civilization. So in the jungle, you are prey. You are in an environment where, you know, there aren't rules. It's survival.
That's right.
It's survival.
Right.
So to be in an environment where there were, you know, acceptable rules and of engagement, everybody knew, you know, you just don't walk up and punch somebody in the face here.
Right.
That's not acceptable. Right. So so that experience really was a relief. And even going back home, I had something to look forward to next week.
That's huge.
You always, and it taught me something. I think we always have to have something to look forward to in life. So right. No matter what you're going through, where you are, if you can keep your eyes on something that you can look forward to, even small, you know, that gives you just enough energy and propulsion to push you through the day or through the week.
That's
or
right.
Whatever, you know?
That's right. So,
excuse me, you know.
So how did you, because, you know, you stuck with horses.
Stuck with horses, yeah.
And did this take you through college, military, whatever? Like, what was the pathway for that? How did that go? I remember we had talked at one point. I remember you said it was important for me to, you know, not even necessarily let the people in the neighborhood know that I was coming back from Rock With These Horses, because...
No, you can't let them know that. You can't tell nobody. You can't tell nobody in Northwest Washington, D.C. that you was coming back from riding a horse.
Right, right.
Well, you could, but, you know, you expect to suffer the repercussions from that. Right,
right, right. So what did you... How did you create things to look forward to later? What else did you have?
So, being at the barn... Just that experience of my grandmother paying for me to take a lesson led to me seeing other kids at the barn who actually hung around all day.
Right.
And they just worked. Yeah. Hang out the barn working. So I just naturally started hanging around the barn working.
Work. Okay.
Cleaning, feeding the horses, and we literally would hang around so that we can get a free ride in the evening.
Right.
So that experience led to me spending more time at the barn, being more exposed to... Not only horses, you know, one of the things I talk about, you know, is being exposed to different sports or different activities also exposes you to different people.
Right.
And that is where change happens more so than the activity itself.
Right.
So being able to be at that barn and being exposed to kids who had a whole different lifestyle, a whole different, you know, expectation, you know, was like, okay, open my eyes to the possibilities of other things, you know?
Right. Talk about some of those possibilities. How many of them did you find yourself engaging with?
Well, knowing that being around kids who had their own horses, there were kids there that, you know, were very well off. I didn't know any friends. I have any friends that owned a horse or any friends that, you know, were what I would consider to be well off in my neighborhood. So to see kids who had things, but then I saw kids who parents had things, but they still worked. They had a work ethic, you know, and I think that... It just exposed me to something other than what I was used to in that environment, which led to me furthering my riding by competing, teaching.
Right.
And I just...
You did this when you were young.
Yeah. So when I was like 14, I worked at a summer camp teaching ride. I was a horse instructor.
Okay.
I taught, just did basic little riding things, more around safety and things around the horses. But it was a great summer job. The counselor, I think it was a Goodwill camp.
Okay.
But the counselor or the camp director paid for me to attend a camp instructor's program.
Wow.
So I was actually got certified as an instructor at about 15 years old.
Wow.
So, and then I rode racehorses at the track.
Okay.
For a job. I just had little things I did.
I know
everything
about that.
Around horses. Yeah. So I went to Bowie State. So in the mornings before I went to school.
Ronice has her hands up. She went to Bowie State.
Yeah. I went to Bowie and I got a. Then I would go to the track at 5 a.m. Mm-hmm. and gallop horses in the morning before I went to school. And
wow.
So I mean, that's my little part time job. I got $5 for every horse I rode.
That's. Wow.
Yeah.
So, did you go to Bowie State? Was that before or after the Navy? When did the Navy come in?
Well, the only reason I went to Bowie was to get into the ROTC program.
Gotcha.
I'll tell you a quick story.
Yeah.
I'm sitting around talking to my grandfather. I'm in 12th grade, about to graduate. And he's like, what are you going to do? And my thought was, well, you know, I think I'm going to become a professional boxer.
Word. You were a boxer.
I used to box, and I thought, you know, I could
you
be...
You like the young renaissance, man. You riding horses. You the most interesting man in the world, bro. You're the most interesting man in the world.
Yeah.
At 15.
Yeah, well, I'm 17 at the time, and Sugar Ray Leonard, was, you know, I mean, I was my idol, man. I mean, I thought, you know, I could become a pro boxer. I really thought I could fight.
Right.
So,
right.
And my grandfather said, I had lawn service at the time, too.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, man, that's a great idea. You should pursue your boxing.
Right.
So he says, what you should do is advertise your lawn service on the bottom of your boxing shoes. So that way, when they knock your ass out, you can advertise. The cameras can show the bottom of your feet.
Come on, man.
Advertise your lawn service.
So he basically told you, you don't need to keep doing that, bro.
I tell him to this day, I said, man, you know, I could have been Floyd Mayweather right now, fooling with you. You killed my dream. Right, but yeah. Oh, man. So the next conversation I had with him was, you know, I'm also considering going into the military. And in some capacity, he was like, and he had such a horrendous experience in the Air Force where, you know, the white officers mistreated him very badly. Mm-hmm. You know, you private military.
I am. I'm private Air Force, absolutely.
Yep. Right, and the white officers treated him so badly, had him doing these terrible jobs, cleaning toilets and everything. And they talked to him in a very disrespectful manner. And when he would tell his story, I literally would feel his pain. And I just see that to be the case of a lot of soldiers and so forth who were in the military in those years. But he told me, he said, if you're going to go in, you need to go in as an officer. Had no idea what an officer was. Went and spoke to my counselor. And he said, well, you got to go to college for that. Mm-hmm. Very disappointed to hear that at that time. I did not want to go to college. But I ended up going to Bowie State for the ROTC program. And by the grace of God, was successfully commissioned second lieutenant in the Army. And it didn't hit home until I was in officer basic school for military police. And the story about my grandfather told me, because a friend and I were walking around base and he had his hands in his pockets. The white MPs rode by and they yelled at him to take his hands out of his pockets. And he said, what? They said, take your hands out your pockets. He said, who are you talking to? Get out the car. I'm like, oh, man, my boy going crazy, man. We about to go to jail. He had those two MPs get out the car, and then when he walked up to me, he said, stand at attention when you're talking to me.
Wow.
See, you see these bars on my shoulders? Don't you ever yell nothing out the car at me. Get in your car and get the hell out of here. And he looked at me and said, man, don't you ever let these people disrespect you, man. You're an officer. And that day, I went home, my car, I wrote a letter to my grandfather. You know, and you know, that was life changing. Just to see that everything he told me, the pain he went through, made it all real for me that day. Because I know how people can be if they don't know that you gotta respect them.
It's like a moment of vindication.
Yeah,
that you can give back to your grandfather.
And, yep, exactly.
In that moment,
exactly. He pinned my shoulders on, my bars on me. So that's
crazy. I know that was that was a really big moment.
Yeah, I'm very proud of that. My service.
Absolutely. Well, I notice every time Veterans Day comes around, Memorial Day, either way, I can count on that picture of young Miguel Wilson.
I got one.
Got the one. I can count on that picture, man. That's a big deal, man. So. Quick transition. So you had a chance to do the military thing. You did the college thing. You know, so much had happened to you. Where you had a lawn service when you were younger. Where did this entrepreneurial spirit come in? When did that?
My grandfather. You know, those rides out to the barn. He would drive me out to the barn a lot of times when I was a kid. And he had a liquor store. And
now, you grew up with your grandparents?
I grew up with my mother and father, but
you spent
my
a lot
father
of time.
Just so you, my father. I got an adopted father. It's like the last name Wilson. Most people know my biological father Raphael because he and I are very close, like brothers. But and he models for me, and he's a really good looking guy.
Good looking guy. I see where you get it.
my dad is pretty famous for his looks.
Yeah,
but I was raised by. My mother's husband, James Wilson, that's how I got, he adopted me when I was a baby. Right. Actually, she was pregnant with me when they got married.
That's amazing.
So he raised me.
That's a good
me.
Man.
Yeah, he was a great man.
Yeah.
And he raised me, and so I grew up with them, and so.
Your grandfather would drive you out to.
He'd drive me out to the barn, and when we were driving out there, he would always tell me, man, work for yourself. Self-employed. Don't want to work for nobody. He just drug that into me. And then my dad Raphael, I had a relationship with him growing up as well.
Yeah.
And he always had his own business. He always had interior design business. He had a store on Wisconsin Avenue.
Word.
And I was very proud of him. I was like, man, that's my father. You know, he had a beautiful store.
Right. Wisconsin, how far up? Was it, we talking Georgetown? We talking, Bethesda.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, right before Bethesda. What's that? Chevy Chase. Yeah. He was in Chevy Chase for 20 years.
For people who don't know, like Bethesda, Chevy Chase, Georgetown, when you say Wisconsin, you're talking about a very affluent area all the way up and down the street.
Yeah.
Here in the D.C. metro area, all the way up to Maryland. And so for somebody, a black man, to have an interior design store back in the 80s, take it, 70s, 80s?
Yeah, 70s, 80s, yeah.
That's no small feat. That's a very big deal.
Yeah, it was, yeah. And I was very proud of him at it. But so between the two of them, it always put into me the desire to be self-employed. So I've had my hands in some type of business since I was in junior high school.
Okay.
I've never not had something since junior high school.
So on that note, just before we go off to break, I'm just gonna bring something full circle just a little bit as we come back to it. You know, we're sitting here at the National Harbor on a corner. As soon as you drive up here on Water Street, and this is prime real estate in a very affluent space, and we're in Miguel Wilson's third location that I know of. The other location that he has is in Phipps, which is that's the big people mall. That's the Louis Vuitton, Gucci. You know, that's, you're only in that spot, and he's got a prime real estate there. As soon as you walk out of, is it Nordstrom? I think it is.
Well, now they're doing a Nobu Hotel, and right outside of my store.
And they're doing a Nobu Hotel
and
right outside. Nobu, if you don't know about good sushi, it's top of the line.
Yeah.
It's $300 for you and your date on a Friday night. If you just having a couple little rolls and a singular drink.
Right. And you're still hungry now.
You're still hungry.
Hey, look.
Not to mention that he also has a boutique in Miami.
Yeah, showroom there.
His showroom in Miami. And so Miguel has never been one to do something small and to do it janky. You always find ways to be at the top of the line and to hold space for people and be a pioneer and blaze a trail at the forefront of everything. And so when we come back, I'm going to talk about how did you get into fashion, and especially high fashion, after the break.
All black at the white shows, white shoes at the black shows, green car for the Cuban links. Y'all sit back and enjoy the light show. Nothing exceeds like success. Style guy gal from having the best of the best is this. Nothing exceeds like success. Style guy gal from having the best of the best is this.
All dressed up in black and white, and you're dressed in that dress I like. Love is swinging in the head tonight. Let me show you a few things.
All right, we're back again with Miguel Wilson, and I'm just going to jump right into it, man. Where did the love of fashion and how did you get into this, and how did you start doing this, and how did you start making money doing this?
Hey, great question. I'm going to try to take a shortcut there for you.
Okay.
Fell in love with fashion because my grandfather and my father were both clothes horses, still are to this day.
Yep.
If I go out with them, I know that's my competition.
Yep.
And they even compete against each other. Although it's my mother's father.
Uh-huh.
And my father, both of them model for me. If you look on the walls right there, you'll see my grandfather in the fashion show there.
Yep.
Right? You look over here, you see my dad right there in the fashion show.
In the front and center.
So our dinners together are very amusing, laughing at the two of them, talking about who models the best, who gets the biggest applause.
Wow.
It's amazing. My grandfather's 91. Uh-huh. His first fashion show with me was 2 years ago, when he was 89 in London.
Oh, you took him to London with you?
Yeah.
Wow.
He's since opened all my shows pretty much. If he's available, he'll open my show for me. And he's always the crowd pleaser coming out.
I had lunch with you and your grandfather that day.
Yeah.
And
he's with me all the time. So yeah, I had dinner with him last night.
That man came. I mean, he was 91. He's moving for 91.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he came up and he was sharp.
Yeah.
And I remember you telling me, he was like, you're like, tell him how long you've had that shirt. And he's just like, 78? 73, 70. I was like, that's my year I was born, bro. And it was clean. It was beautiful.
If you got a shirt in 78, it's one of his newer shirts.
Wow.
He got stuff from the 60s and 50s, man.
Wow, it was killing
and
it, man.
And it looked brand new. Amazing. All his clothes are brand new. Amazing, he takes care of amazingly, right? So those two really have my biggest influences in terms of style and dress. And they tell me I can't dress too well. It's amazing. But so I got into, I used to have my suits made at a young age. I worked, had a corporate job with Pillsbury.
Okay.
And one of my friends was my, he made suits for me.
Okay.
And I fell in love with having my suits made. Something about having my name in them just really just.
It's yours.
It's mine, you know. So I remember going to my 10-year high school reunion. Man, I opened my jacket up, showed my friends my lining and my name in it. It was amazing.
So how'd you get into making suits yourself?
So it's a very same friend. He was working for a company and then decided to branch out on his own. Asked me to partner with him.
Okay.
So I literally, you know, it's a passion of mine, and I made a hefty investment and worked it just like I did my job, although it was part-time.
Mm-hmm.
So I really learned the business from him through that process.
So you didn't go to any kind of fashion school?
I never
or anything
studied
like that?
Fashion. I went, and actually, after about a year or two, I sold him my share of that company and went back to grad school. And I got my master's in business.
Mm-hmm.
And when I graduated, there's nothing else I wanted to do. I wanted to be back in fashion. I loved what I was doing before.
Right.
And, you know, I didn't want a job, you know, so forth. So I just, I actually had to pay him to get back in the business. I had a non-compete clause.
Okay.
So I paid him money so I can get back in fashion, started another company up, and I was back rolling.
That's it.
Yeah, that was it. And
what were you selling?
Custom suits.
Where?
All over the country. You know, I used to do a lot of pastors.
Okay.
And stuff. You know, my oldest client to this day is still doing suits right now. Bishop Glenn Staples.
Okay.
He's here in the Maryland area. But I've been making suits since 96.
Wow.
Yeah, he's my oldest client. And so a lot of, I did, you know, T.D. Jakes back when he was in West Virginia. We were doing like all the, a lot of guys you know today that's really well known. I've been doing this for a long time. Jamal Bryant, I was doing this stuff when he was in, at Morehouse.
Wow.
He was
okay.
a student.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of pastoral, I have a lot of pastoral friends.
How'd you end up in the sort of in the business of being the celebrity stylist for anybody who's getting married? Anybody
know,
who's, if you think you're getting married and you are famous, if you're not wearing a Miguel Wilson, like, I don't know who is you.
Right.
I don't know who is you.
I agree with you.
I agree.
Is that one, I get one ego checks on that one?
No, that's facts. That ain't facts. Ego.
That's, okay. So,
that's facts.
So this is what happened. In 2011, I had one of the most catastrophic endings to a period. My business failed. I had executive clothiers. And what happened is I had started a hotel type business
mm-hmm.
called Executive Boutique Suites. So I had all these buildings, and we converted them into luxury suites,
mm-hmm.
and we provided all of the services, amenities with them. It's kind of like Airbnb,
right?
But it was
ahead of its time.
It was ahead of its time. Yeah. The wrong business model,
right?
Because I owned the real estate versus just
right
getting it from other people,
right?
So, and the market crashed, and I was taking money from my clothing business, trying to keep my hotel business rolling.
Oh, this is around when the
2009, 2010, 2011.
Crazy.
And so basically, man, it never recovered. It just kept going down, down, down. And finally, just, you know, I was at a point I just couldn't cash flow any longer. So I had to let everything go.
Mm-hmm.
So I had been saving. I had been a prolific investor and saver for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm at 44 years old and lost everything I had worked for all my life at 44. So
how'd you feel, man?
In some ways, to be honest with you, I was relieved because I had so much pressure for so many years trying to hold on. I was holding on by my fingertips every month, coming up with $25,000 to pay bills.
Right.
And, you know, just the stress and struggle. But I created it. I created the problem myself. It wasn't just the properties and the business. It was my lifestyle, too, you know.
Yeah.
I had nice cars. I had a boat. you know, I'm doing too much. Right. I'm doing too much of everything.
Right, right.
Balling, you know.
Of course.
So, you know, just that the lifestyle, the perk, everything. So the day out went to bankruptcy.
Oh, no, this was official loss.
Yeah, it's official.
Bankruptcy.
Yeah, bankruptcy.
Okay.
Bro. Official.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I had turned all that over. Yeah. I gave him everything. I said, take it all. And then now, in hindsight, I probably should have held on one or two, and I probably could have, but I was in such mental trauma that I couldn't think clearly and just wanted to get away from the pain and the suffering that it didn't matter. I had to give him, you know, an arm and a testicle with it. Okay. If they didn't say it, that's what I needed to get out, you know.
That's a lot of pain, bro.
Yeah, I would have took that.
That's a lot of pain. Give up testicles. That's a lot of pain.
Exactly.
Arm, you can give him about the arm. Testicle.
Arm and a testicle. They could take both of them.
Man, okay.
But it was a relief, man, because finally for a day I ain't had to worry about paying a bill. Man, you know, it just wasn't worth it. And so, you know, some days you got to relive the fact that, you know what, you just lost everything. I had nothing. And then to think that, you know, had I turned right instead of turning left, I could be retired right now. If I did this or did that, I had me some serious cash right now. You know what I mean? If I wouldn't have done it, you know, you can go through 1,000 scenarios of what ifs and could end up in a lot of other different places besides being broke. And I did go through some depression, and I had to start over. I mean, I had days where I didn't want to get out of bed. I had days where, you know, I just want to get up and get me a drink and go back to bed.
That's right.
You know, and
how'd you pay for things through that process?
After I filed bankruptcy, it took a while for them to take one of my properties. And I just kind of made a makeshift office down there. It flooded on me one day.
Right.
And but I had a makeshift office there. I worked out there. I had no rent in there, nothing. So I was able to use that property. And, you know, I still had clients and people that, you know, supported my business. But it just wasn't on the level.
The same, right.
And at this point, I'm just trying to pay bills and so forth, you know. So,
right.
You know, I still had kids, young kids. And my wife at the time and I were going through divorce. You know, one thing that was important to me was that I felt like I was responsible for the condition I put her in. Mm-hmm. As well as my kids in. So my main responsibility was to make sure that they are all right. So I did make every effort to not impact their lives, to have these problems impact their lives. So the way they live, the standard in which they lived, and their expectations, I wanted them to be able to maintain, you know, my son rode horses, make sure he keeps riding lessons. And, you know, it was just certain things.
So you were still able to piece together.
I was piecing
together. Yeah. So they didn't really get to feel the heaviness of the impact. You still took that pressure to some extent.
You know, I moved out. They weren't in a big house no more. They were in an apartment. And, you know, kids are so resilient, though, man. I think, you know, and a lot of times we try to protect them from so much. But, you know, sometimes experiencing real helps them mature and grow and develop better than, you know, than having that protective layer over top of all their lives, you know. So they had to deal with life in a lot of different ways too. So that was awakening for us all.
Did your son keep riding?
Yeah, he rode. He went on and rode professionally for a while. One time we thought he was going to try to go to the Olympics or something, but he's not riding anymore. He got burnt out. He rode for so long, and he had a good run.
You mentioned something. You just brought it up, and so you actually reminded me. You have a very interesting story about ride to the Olympics, and I want to hear.
Yeah.
I want everybody to
hear
about
that.
So
it's funny. My son. I'll tell you how it started. My son came to me one day when I was going through this very horrific part. He said, "Dad, I want to ride seriously," and I know the type of money it takes to ride seriously, and I knew I wasn't in that position. And I said, and he deserved it. I mean, this kid, straight A student, he didn't do nothing but ride horses. You know, I remember one day I got on him about how he was dressed. I said, "Man, you know, I'm a designer. How you look? You look terrible, man. You can't keep dressing like this." And he looked at me and said, "Dad, I'm a straight A student. I ride horses. What's the problem?" And I said, "Dress like you want to dress." But yeah. So, what's the question?
I said, it's an interesting story about ride to the Olympics.
So my son said he wanted to ride, and I was like, you know, I don't have the money to do this. However, it's different ways that you can do things. And so we sat around and strategized on how he could do this. So one of the ideas I thought about was, listen, you know, if you position yourself to go try to go to the Olympics, I think, and you'd be the first African-American to ride in the Olympics, I think a lot of people, especially these little old ladies, will give you $5 to help you do it.
Right.
Okay? And that means your training now. That means your equipment now. That means everything you need to help you get there. Right. So we need to create a platform in which people can contribute to that. And I think we should make it bigger than just you. I think it should include other kids and other opportunities for kids who may want to do the same thing.
Right.
So that day, we birthed Ride to the Olympics. And we created things. We had some we created programs. We had brought kids out to the barns, and we've done stuff with a lot of kids. And he and I did that for a few years. It was just on a very small scale. And he eventually got a job working for one of the top trainers. So when he was 15, he left home and never came back.
Wow.
He left home at 15, riding horses professionally. He'd ride 10 horses a day. He was living his dreams and traveling the country.
These horses create freedom.
Yeah. He rode horses every day for 3 years until he went to college.
Wow. So I'm going to take one last break. And then when we come back, I want to talk about additional freedoms that you're able to create through the horses.
Sure.
And then we can start to wrap it up. I also want you to talk about the fashion and polo extravaganza that you do every year. But
right. Well, you know, you asked me a question that I did not address yet, and I think it's worthy of discussion.
Go for it, man. We'll take a few extra minutes. Go ahead.
Okay. So you asked me about, you know, how did you become the guy for the weddings?
Yeah.
And during my recovery, sitting down, I'm thinking about, you know, reinventing myself. How do I want to... I have to make the most of the time I am here now. I need to rebuild. And so what's the strategy going to be? And I just said, you know, 10 years from now, I want to be a Tom Ford. I want to be, you know, on that level. That's what I really would like to do. I would like to be a well-known fashion designer. Mm-hmm. And I looked at how a lot of these guys did it. And how they did it, you know, when I think about Ralph Lauren, he became famous from the shirts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you start looking at each designer, they became known for one thing first. And then they took the brand across other platforms and things, right? So I started thinking about, what's the one thing I can do that could give me a name and stand out? I've done weddings for years. Yeah. And it always bothered me that, you know, men didn't take weddings more seriously, getting dressed for wedding, as the women did.
Right.
You know, so
They rent tuxedos.
The girl's spending $5,000 on the gown, you coming up with a $2 tux.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was an opportunity to show guys different ways and options and ways they can get excited about. And I just thought the whole wedding business was bad for men. I mean, women actually go to the store together, and they sharing champagne, and they looking at dresses, and they make an event out of it. It's an experience.
Right.
So I felt that I couldn't create an experience for men. Okay. And I created the tagline, because it's his day too. And that resonated with people. And I think just creating the looks I created, which was such looks that at the time, you know, you just didn't see guys wearing these colors and these styles and designs and so forth. And particularly talking about it from a wedding standpoint. So that resonated with brides, the women. And women would tell the men, go see Miguel.
Right.
Go over this place over here. And even the Gucci and Versace and all these places in the mall, oh, you want something really nice, different? Okay, go see Miguel in there. So they literally send clients to me all the time, too.
Wow.
So that they, you know, they don't do what I do.
Wow.
So that's created, and I just want to use my name. Before that time, I always had, like, executive clothiers or other names. So I said, you know what? Miguel Wilson is good enough. And put my name on the door.
We are taking a break right there. We'll be back in just a moment. Okay, we're back. I'm having a really good time getting to know you again, Miguel.
Yes, sir.
Like I said, I think I know so much about you, and every time I get around you, I get something new and something different, and I learn something. And so, and I feel a little more free because there are things that you do and decisions that you've made that, you know, I'm behind you by a number of years, and so I'm coming through different stages and moments in my own life where perhaps I think I'm balling out and making it, and you're helping me. You're helping me sidestep a lot of things through your story, and so I appreciate it, man.
That is so important. I know you had an agenda, but I'm going to tell you, this is why I'm writing my book.
Yeah.
This is why I'm writing my book, because you don't have to go through every experience if someone can help you sidestep a few bombs and things.
Yeah.
But I'll leave you just one thing about the book that...
Well, talk about the book. Let's go. Talk about the book.
I'm going to tell you, but one thing about this book that I think is life changed to a degree. Think about it this way. We like to think about our emotions, particularly our problems and emotional pains we go through, as just things we don't want to experience. They're hurtful. They're things we try to avoid. But I think in hindsight, I think God has created every emotion for a purpose. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to feel certain things in order to respond to it. Sometimes going through that certain pain may take you backwards a little first. You know, sometimes you gotta go lay down, get your head there, you gotta regroup. You know, if you suffer a concussion on the field, sometimes you gotta step off the field and get on the sideline for a minute.
Yeah,
and get your head back together before you can go back out. Right.
That's right.
Same thing when you're going through a traumatic experience in life, be it a failed business,
mm-hmm.
or a loss of a job, or even, you know, a failed relationship. You know, we go through certain pains, but I think all those pains you go through are to serve you, to elevate you, to bring you to the next level. Okay, mm-hmm. you know, so many people have been inspired by losing that job to go start a business, not wanting to go through that trauma again. You know what I mean?
So right.
Same thing in relationships. Sometimes, you know what? I'm going to make this person regret leaving me, okay? So I'm going to go and get my life together. I'm going to go make some money. I'm going to go, get healthy and lose some weight or work out or something. You know what I mean? So these pains you go through are actually one of the greatest catalysts for change. You know, you don't have catalysts of change from good things. Change comes from problems and hurt and so forth. So if you can find a way to embrace a problem as a form of inspiration,
mm-hmm.
you see it differently. Right? And this is one of the areas of my book, so...
What's the book called?
I don't know yet.
You working on it?
I'm still working on the title.
So I'm gonna cipher right off of that, these catalysts for change. So early on, you mentioned, turning it into something that's good. You mentioned that your son had these dreams of going to the Olympics,
mm-hmm.
and there was no money for that.
Mm-hmm.
It was pain.
Mm-hmm.
So you used that opportunity to turn that into a new foundation, and not just a foundation metaphorically, but an actual foundation for other people to grow, man, and change from, to expose other kids to this.
Real talk. Had I had the money for my son to ride horses, I never would have created Ride to the Olympics,
mm-hmm.
which led to me creating Atlanta Fashion and Polo Classic.
Right.
Which led me to create and help co-found Morehouse Polo Team.
That's right.
All because I didn't have the money.
The creativity came out of the lack, not the abundance in this case.
Exactly.
The pain. So you want to talk about the Atlanta Fashion Polo Classic? Just let everybody know what that's about.
Because
I know it needs to come to D.C.,
now, Ego's going to come out here.
It's all
bit.
Good, man.
He's
come to
this
D.C. Plus, it's Derby season coming up, man.
Right.
And, you know, I need something. I got to go to Gold Cup. I need something.
So let me tell you something about Miguel Wilson, period, okay?
Mm-hmm.
People have low expectations when we think about black business. I in turn do everything I do to counteract that thought process. Mm-hmm. I think luxury. I think high-end. I think special. I think exceptional. Mm-hmm. On the service, on the clothing, on the quality, on the experience.
Yep.
Okay? Atlanta Fashion Polo Classic is a luxury event where culture and class connect. So what does that mean? It is the, generally speaking, at a polo event or something on that caliber, let's face it, it's a white event, mm-hmm. right? And with that culture, experience.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the experience and what's the culture? The culture is the clothing, the food,
mm-hmm.
the music.
That's right.
The drinks.
That's right.
So this year at Polo Classic, for instance, we're doing we got three tents. One of the tents will be African, Latin, and Caribbean music.
Wow.
Okay. The other tent's going to be house music.
Yep.
Go-go music.
Yep.
And trap.
Of course, go-go.
Right.
Of course, go-go.
Exactly. But my point, though, is, and it still is a luxury event.
Absolutely.
So,
because our culture is luxury.
Exactly. So, the perception of us is always less. And I'm saying to everyone, hey, you know, you can do something for us the way we like to do it, and don't let them define what luxury is for us. Because, quite frankly, we are defining it every day in fashion. We're saying what's cool.
Right.
Today, even, you know, like in fashion, you know, the influencers and so forth are really dictating what is cool and so forth, versus in the old days where it was Vogue magazine,
right.
or, you know, what some designer over in Europe is saying is cool. We're listening to our own now, and I think that we have a voice. And
that's word.
It's for us to express that, you know?
That's word. So you seem to be very deliberate about everything that you do. You think about bigger themes, ultimate goals. You're driven by a lot of purpose. And so it only makes sense to me that you know, it would be attached to you that the very first polo team at an HBCU, you know, composed entirely of young black men, would be something that is attached to you. Can you talk a little bit about that, where that comes in? What problem were you solving when you did that?
Great question. Well, the thing was with the, I hired a young lady. I met her on an airplane about a year ago, and I talked to her about the ride to the Olympics. We're coming from Aruba, and I said, man, I really need somebody to run this foundation, really pick it up. And on that plane, she said, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
And man, when I tell you, God moves in mysterious ways. She's been the catalyst for where we are now, even with the team, because she's injected so much leadership, and just I can say something to her and she goes and make it happen.
Right.
And that's such a powerful thing to have. The foundation, what we want to do is be able to take inner city kids and expose them
mm-hmm.
to horses, horse sports, and activities and things. As I stated earlier, exposing them to the horses is the catalyst, but really the purpose is to expose them to opportunity. Opportunities come as a result of being at a barn and meeting or a polo field and meeting guys who are on boards,
mm-hmm.
meeting guys who own companies, meeting guys who give them opportunities and access to things they otherwise wouldn't. You know, I believe that we have a country of really good people, good-hearted people. The problem is that they're not going to the hood.
That's
they're
right.
not going to an environment where a lot of these kids who need this would benefit from it. So the horses is our opportunity to take them from their natural environments, bring them out, just like with me. I talked about my experience driving out from the barn, driving from the house to out to the barn,
yeah.
and taking the kids out from their neighborhoods and bringing them out to the barn and doing that ride. They get to the transition of experience. But also when they get there, to meet people that they otherwise would never meet, gives them and exposes them to things that they would never do. Like, I just showed you a email, okay?
Yeah.
Where...
Yeah, you talk about
South,
that, please.
South African... the country, South Africa...
Ministry of Tourism.
Ministry of Tourism is inviting me and the polo team, Morehouse Polo Team, to South Africa to play.
Yeah.
And phenomenal. And then I'm going to tell you what that means, okay? And let me put this into perspective for you on another level. In 2008, we had the first black president in the United States of America. It took 12 more years to get the first black polo team. That's the first thing I'm going to tell you. Let that sink in for 1 second. All right? Now, for us to bring, and we do this regularly, we bring these kids from the inner city out to the polo field to watch these black kids, these young men, practicing playing polo. They've never seen anything like that, and they're so intrigued by it. And they're so, these kids are their heroes now. They sign autographs, and these kids looking up to these kids like, wow, you know, you are somebody I'm looking up to. Versus just somebody that might play football, or somebody that might be selling drugs, or somebody who doing other, these other things.
Right.
So to give them
more options, more exposure.
More options and exposure. But, you know, so what does it do? You know, I just think it's going to change lives. Inevitably, it will change some lives. It did for me. So right. I have to believe that it could do the same for others, right? So it's the same thought process.
Wow. That level of exposure is huge. I just, as we wrap this up, man, I just want to say I appreciate your personal dedication to making the most of bad situations and not just making the most of them for yourself. Mm-hmm. For looking at ways to make the most of that so that it affects everybody else in the process and continuing to expose others so that opportunities abound for everyone. And so that's major to me. And on top of that, listen, I love following your Instagram, hearing what you got to say. You're always lots of positive energy. And every now and then, you know, I know you don't do it to brag, but it's good to see, kind of the humble brag where you have the biggest of the stars, the A-listers who come into your shop in many different ways. And sometimes they're there during the day for other people to meet.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're doing something private. And so can you tell
validate.
Everybody?
Sometimes you got to validate people, you know, I mean, all I try to stick with, and this is my basic thoughts about my Instagram and my messaging, is stick to facts.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody can ever argue with me about a fact. So I can talk. I don't talk about opinions about things. I don't talk about, what I feel. Okay, I'm gonna deal with facts. I'm gonna show you.
Yeah.
So therefore, you may feel or think whatever you want about Miguel Wilson. He think he this. He think he that. He whatever it is. All I'm delivering to you is the facts, and you can judge it how you want to from there. So. It may come across as a brag. In some cases, guess what? You know, I need to show some people what time it is, you know, because everybody's not respectful.
That's right.
You know what I mean? So you need to understand who you're dealing with.
That's true.
I'm not, you know, because we...
Not no run-of-the-mill, nothing.
You're not going to just treat
Miguel Wilson.
You're not going to treat Miguel Wilson in any kind of way. You're not going to treat nobody who's involved with me in any kind of way. Okay, we require and demand respect because we give it.
Get your ass back in that car. Don't say nothing
exactly.
to nobody.
You see these bars on his shoulder?
Exactly.
Yeah, there you go.
Exactly.
You
know, those are the bars on
right
the shoulder.
Right now, I'm going to say, you're going to see these stripes on my back. You understand?
That's right.
You see these stripes on my back? I took a whooping. I took plenty of them.
Right.
Okay, and, you know, I just want to make it easier. And I think the thing is, for me, at this stage in my life, is that I operate from this space of love, regardless. Even if you come across like I'm ridiculing, whatever, it's always about love. I mean, that's the most powerful emotion in the world. That's the only thing I'm caring about spreading with anybody. I don't do negative on no level with nobody.
So where can people come and follow you and see some of this love and experience some of that?
My Instagram is where I spend a lot of my time. Miguel Wilson Collection.
Uh-huh.
That's primary. You know, I travel extensively. We're about to do a tour, quite frankly, into multiple cities. I'm going to, in April, we're doing New York City, Chicago, Houston, and Dallas. And so we're taking private appointments for brides and so forth, grooms, to see and speak to me personally. I can design, you know, this is the thing, too. You know, and it's all around the fashion. I have a gift. I don't talk about it a lot, but you see it every day.
Yeah.
Speaking of the facts, God has blessed me. The fact that I never, you know, I have several degreed fashion designers that, I have several degreed fashion designers that work with me. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, have went to school on many levels. I haven't, but they respect me. And the fact is that God has blessed me with a gift that's undeniable at this point. So you get a chance to work with a guy such as myself to design your wedding attire during this tour. So
That's beautiful. I can attest to one this gift. I was standing in front of him one time asking, you know, okay, you're not going to pull out the tape and measure me? And that man looked at me. He's like, nah, I got it. And I was just like, okay. When I got that jacket, it fit perfect.
Yeah.
And that's just a testament to your talent and your abilities and your hard work and the amount of time you put in doing this stuff, man. So we really appreciate you coming on this show and giving us your time and your storyline.
Thank you,
and,
man.
I'm going to go and give a few shout-outs as well. Winging It is created, written, produced, and presented by Ronice Henneman, Nicole Harden, Emil Bryant, Brianna Paris Crutchfield, Trinity Elder, and AC Dutch.
Hey.
And if you can, follow and like the Winging It podcast on Instagram, at Winging It the podcast. On Twitter, we are at the podcast Winging It. We flip it. And then you can probably find us on Facebook and LinkedIn at the same, at the podcast Winging It. If you want to listen to us, you can do so on Apple, Google, anywhere that they got some damn podcasts, you can actually find us. That's what it is, right? So thank you for listening to Winging It, the podcast for people who don't have their shit together. Shout out to Athena Cross. We miss you, love. All right. Peace.
Peace.
Fighting over reigns, wrong be the game, but long live the chief. For a little old thing, little boys bang bang. Long live the chief. Fighting over reign, wrong be the game, but long live the chief. Yeah, watch pretty mama while I slay my cane. Long live the chief. Cockroaches in the rats. Hand me downs with the patches. Mama put a little money in the mattress. Taught me how to make a silver spoon out of plastic. You can either sink, swim, or be the captain. Get the last word, I'ma get the last laughing. Now they say you're dinner while you're dressing so classy. I don't want my best dressed day in a casket. You can either lead, follow, or get out the way. Make a full move, it will make my full day. Got a 100-year plan, you just think about the day. Always been about time, more than been about pay. Y'all up with me, Usain couldn't run with me. Chief come to find you, you don't come for me. At best, you can run a little company. At worst, I could run the whole country, that's right. Pimp game like a brothel, that's why. I don't judge a new tassel. I Airbnb the crib like a hostel. Summer rate cheaper, could the streets get hostile? Shot the boy, this far from a hobby boy. So no, I won't record for your homie boy. I turn the party out like a naughty toy. Then I go and hide in plain sight like a lobby boy. Yes, sir, that your dinner on the banner. Riding for my getting locked up in a slammer. Elder saying everything's a nail to a hammer. And can't spell, but we know I Instagrammer. Well done, better than well said. I read new, well a nigga well read. Really, I ain't met nobody smarter. That's why I got admitted, but I still rejected Harvard. I'm the Fresh Prince in a school where they couldn't read. Mama put me in a school with the Kennedys. When I met Bill Clinton, I was 17. But dead presidents was on my knee. Dining with the governor's daughter. And the father say, I remind him of Obama. I'm the chief diplomat.